What does it take to make workshops work? And how can we facilitate collaboration that sticks and leads to results? My name is Miriam Hapness, and with the Workshops Work podcast, I'm on the mission to find the magic ingredients to make workshops work. Today with me on the show is Yvonne Le Borgne, and we talk about process literacy and how this relates to collaborative work and how groups can self-facilitate without a facilitator. So stay tuned. And by the way, if you don't have pen and paper at hand to take your own notes, why don't you just scroll down, look into the show notes to download my free one-page summary. And now, enjoy the show. Yvonne, looking forward to our conversation. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be with you today.
Yes, me too. And before we dive into the topic and the further conversation, I always like to hear the story first. Would you tell us when you started calling yourself a facilitator?
So, well, actually, I didn't call myself a facilitator for a very long time because I mean, even now I'm working as a freelancer and I do a lot of facilitative work, but yeah, it's still only one of the things that I do somehow. So there was a moment when I started really getting a little bit more into facilitation where I maybe tended to look at myself as a facilitator, but it was not for a very long stretch. And I also had an epiphany when talking with Sam Gaynor from Community at Work when he really explained to me also what his perspective of also his work, which is really using facilitation as a skill that you can put to use for many different things. And I think it's it really resonated with me because also facilitation is often related to meetings in particular. A lot of facilitators are really meeting facilitators. And I think that I wish that the work that I do goes beyond just facilitating meetings and into much wider collaboration processes. So long answer for your question. Sorry for that.
Please don't apologize for long answers because that's what you're here for. And I love this question and like to start with it because maybe most of my guests would say that they don't call themselves facilitators and still the work they do is facilitating. Mm-hmm. And I'm still wondering what it is that we find the label facilitator so restrictive. So maybe it's not sexy enough.
I don't know. There was actually a t-shirt that was saying like, people call me facilitator, but I'm like a wicked problem cracker or something. And it was like a really, really cool, I could look it up and share it with you. It's really nice. But yeah, I think I think a lot of us are just doing that among other things. And I think, I mean, for me, it's also now very consciously associated with another idea, which is I really am pushing a little bit of my work away from the central place of the facilitator. I'm sort of, I'm really in a space and in a mood to desacralize the function of the central facilitator. And so, calling myself the facilitator is basically, I want to destroy my stage, kill my darling.
I love that. And what do you mean by that? So is the next step after the facilitator?
So interestingly, I started this morning at 3 o'clock in the morning because every 6 to 8 weeks I have a study group cycle with the same group from a Community at Work in San Francisco. They invite all the people that have been following their multi-stakeholder collaboration course to reflect on multi-stakeholder collaboration. And this cycle is around online facilitation. And there was actually this question of how do you see the future of your work with this facilitative skills? What is going to be different, etc.? And I really do think that this is actually one of the things that's pushed even more by this move to online and now already and more so towards hybrid meetings of distributing the facilitative skill across the entire group of people that is interacting with each other. So that means really elevating the process, the collaborative literacy of both the leaders or sponsors of a particular event or initiative or whatever, obviously of the people who are more centrally in charge of facilitating interactions, but also all the participants or contributors that are joining a particular gathering. Once everyone starts understanding what it takes to advance together on a topic all the magic of process behind their interactions, I think everyone is actually better able individually and as groups to move forward towards healthy and productive solutions. So I think that's the direction we're going towards. Not to say it's easy.
No, if it was easy, then it wouldn't need to be facilitated, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I do like the vision of groups self-facilitating their problem-solving process and their collaborative work. And I have a few questions about that. One would be about the skill set or mindset that these group members would need in order to make this happen. So how do you balance then group dynamics and different personalities? And also whether you would see that this is an option for any kind of workshop and collaborative work. So how to, if, for instance, sometimes the outside perspective is important to get in, but maybe it isn't.
Yeah, so I think, first of all, to answer your question on the whether it's for all types of meetings, I think further down the line, yes, I think it's for any type of interactions. And I think also, again, working in online and hybrid environments, there's a lot more potential for asynchronous interactions. I mean, until now, it was, I mean, all face-to-face is premised on being together in one place. So, of course, you have to base interactions on that. But once you have asynchronous, there's a lot of things you can do, even for group decision making, that I think is going to progressively transform itself as we go further. And sorry, I missed maybe the beginning of your question on this. What was the other part?
The second question.
Oh, yeah, the skill set and the attitude. That was that. I think as far as skill set attitudes, first of all, it's like it's recognizing what process is. I think that really, for me, this is, I mean, my work exists to equip people, organizations, networks with process literacy, language, skills, tools, so that they can bring their whole self and they can connect their whole self with others to crack really difficult problems that they wouldn't be able to crack together. Mm-hmm. And I think so one part of that is really the understanding what is process and how it works, etc. As part of that, there's some specific things such as particularly, I think, group dynamics. I think group decision making is also a really fundamental aspect of that. I think it's also recognizing who you are. So bringing the self as instruments, whether, again, you're a facilitator, you're a leader, you're a contributor of other kinds. I think it's about understanding this. And the attitude, I think, is primarily, I would say, two. It's curiosity and empathy, which is, curiosity vis-a-vis the different topics and curiosity vis-a-vis others and having a knack for wanting to get the perspective of others on a given issue. I think if everyone cultivates that already, even without all the rudiments of facilitation, a group is much better equipped to actually work with each other better.
Two things that I would like to unpack. One is the process literacy. And if I understand it correctly, this means understanding that any type of collaborative work is not just a workshop, but it is a process that combines asynchronous work with synchronous work. And I totally agree that, especially now, since we have been forced to work remotely, we came to realize that we don't have to sit in the same room for all the bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. And I think that the workshops and meetings we have now, by definition and circumstances, they are much more focused on the content, because all the coffee moments and chit chats are kind of taken apart because we don't have this kind of personal space, intimate space with turning to our neighbors. Mm-hmm. So I wonder whether we first have to, and maybe these two are combined, whether we have to detach ourselves from the false belief that we have to do everything together in the same room. For instance, like a brainstorming, or you mentioned the example of decision making. Do we really have to be in the same room? Or maybe it could be healthier to actually give everyone space to think about it, do the brainstorm, put the stickies on a digital white wall, and then come together to discuss. And how does it relate to process literacy? So in order to make this work, what is there to learn? Or what do we get wrong about processes in general that I have never even thought about the concept of process literacy before you mentioned it?
Well, I think for me, I mean, to maybe also crack that nut of what is process literacy. If you look at what people do when they collaborate or when they meet and they have conversations, they focus on the what. That's the content. It's what are they talking about? What are they doing something with each other about, etc. Everything that is around that, the why do we do it, the how do we do it, the who, when, where, for me, that's process. And so process literacy is just realizing that if you just keep focusing on the what you want to talk about, you're missing out on the conditions for the what. And you're also restricting your senses to it, because the what is usually, again, at least in face-to-face and synchronous moments, it's focusing on the spoken word. The how, etc., starts involving all your other senses, almost all the way to your nose, etc., but certainly your eyes. Your eyes see the process, you know, and you sense things that are not spoken. And that is something that, yeah, I think people can really see this. So, yeah.
But wouldn't this mean, especially when we talk about all the senses, wouldn't this mean that it's even a bigger challenge to do this in an online world and asynchronously? Or is it enough to have our senses in our own four walls?
I mean, asynchronously, yeah, it just brings another set of challenges. So I think that's why for me, yeah, process literacy is also helpful in rethinking all of that. The basic opportunity we have now is actually to keep on rethinking our options and to rethink our processes, because we just see that we need to adapt for online and now for hybrid environments, and indeed starting to unpack all kinds of ways to do it. So even decision making, indeed, that can be done asynchronously and using platforms and using visual platforms, using many different things, many different tools. At the end of the day, I think it's again, it boils down to that mindset and that attitude of paying attention. I mean, if you want to have decision making, it's not so much getting everyone together at the same time in a room that will make the difference. The difference is you need to really make sure that you understand all the perspectives that can influence the way that a group is going towards a particular decision. And if you're not paying due diligence to that, well, at least if you're seeking consensual decision making, you're not going to hit the mark. Because the trick in that is also that not every context, not every dynamics requires consensual decision making either. And I think for me, this is one of the cruxes of again, process literacy. If leaders, if participants, if facilitators don't understand the type of dynamics that you're in, everyone is like having completely different expectations about their role, about what they're supposed to bring, etc. And I think that creates a lot of problems in the way that people are engaging with each other.
So would it then mean... So how I translate it for myself is that obviously we start with the why. And then when it comes to process, it's basically a sequence of conversations, alignment, and decisions that need to take place in a certain order. And then there might be some if conditions around the way, but this is how I imagine process. And then everyone needs to agree on this process and to understand its logic. Is this what you mean by process literacy?
I think process literacy looks at all of this. I mean, again, you know, if I think this is like a regular thing with words and concepts. I see always some value in having conversations about linguistics and what you mean with things. But if something doesn't resonate with you, do away with it and find something else that does work for you. But I think to look at your example, I don't think that every interaction is necessarily leads to a decision to be taken either. See, that's the thing. In one typology, type one meetings are really informative meetings. So someone comes and say, just passes on information. This is what we have decided. This is going to be a new policy. This is this piece of research that we've done, whatever. The only job for everyone else is to understand what is going on there, but not to actually question it or influence it or anything. And at type two, you start having consultative dynamics, then you really pick the brains of people to really sort of influence how the decision makers are going to make a decision about it. And in type three, collaborative, explorative, then you might actually come up with a decision that needs everyone's input to really advance to a sustainable agreement. But even then, it doesn't need to be a decision. It could just be a joint exploration with no one playing any particular role. Not everything has to lead to a decision either, interestingly. But I think we have, you see, because it's a little bit like facilitation and particularly meetings, taking the sort of collaboration aside for a bit. Because everyone does it, it's like communication. Everyone thinks that they know it, but they don't. I mean, we don't. We are so poorly equipped. I mean, it's incredible that now there's like much more trainings on facilitation, etc. But it should be like a life skill that is taught from early age, because it's so essential to be able to work with each other, to listen to each other carefully, to do things together. So
I totally agree. facilitating as a life skill, which is related, as you said, to listening, to curiosity, which goes far beyond the meeting room. I mean, it happens at every dinner or breakfast table, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like this guy on a masterclass of negotiations that reminding us every day we face, like, I don't know, 50 or 60 negotiations. You know, crossing a street is a negotiation. Talking about where to have dinner is a negotiation. All of that.
And this actually points exactly to the struggle I had previously when you said sometimes we don't need to take decisions or we are not taking decisions. And I would dare to challenge that, because I think we are taking decisions constantly, whether I say something or I don't say something, whether I listen to the group or I don't listen to the group, who moves forward with what idea. And I think most of the time in our awake lives, we take decisions by not doing anything, which is also a decision.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So maybe to be more detailed, what I meant is like a group doesn't have to take a particular decision towards a particular productive outcome. Mm. Everyone does take decisions about themselves, and a facilitator and a leader in particular have a particular role to play in an interaction about the decisions. Yes, for sure.
Yeah. Which brings us back to another conversation that we had previously, a few minutes ago, coming back to the group self-facilitating and whether this model of having everyone facilitating instead of having one with a label facilitator on its forehead. Mm-hmm. And I wondered to what extent or how you would deal with the risk that some are willing to take more space in a conversation and then guide or pull the conversation or discussion into a direction that might not have been the purpose or where someone has a different idea about that. So if you have this distributed power across a group without one who is in charge of guiding, how would you deal with that?
Well, I mean, this is the thing that I think in many environments, it doesn't really happen that there is no, well, actually, no, it does happen that there's a lot of unfacilitated initiatives.
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately, yeah, exactly. I think right now we're not at a stage where that can really happen in most cases very meaningfully or healthily. Frankly, even if you take, like, for instance, a bunch of facilitators themselves left on their own devices, it's such a mess. I mean, we're actually not pretty good at following instructions and at practicing what we preach when with each other somehow. I mean, I've noticed that. I've witnessed that several times. Yeah, but I do
like
think that.
Cats.
But there's also a point to the people that take space. I think there's a lot of ways that. I mean, I used to really early on in my facilitative career or pathway, I tended to look at these people as a problem in the equation. Because they're visible and because I really had very little tolerance for people that monopolize the conversation. And I think, you know, I work in the Netherlands. I think the Netherlands is the country that has invented, because of the Polder model, consensus-based model, you know, if it was not for that, the country would have gone underwater. So they invented the problem of acute meetingitis. It was really invented here. And I think it gives you a serious life skill development opportunity to say no to meetings that suck and to really pick your dynamics in there. So there's something interesting about that. But yeah, I've sort of walked away from that because these people are actually very important. People that are quick to think on their toes and share ideas are the ones that actually inject some energy in any conversation at the beginning. And you also need that. Of course, if you just linger with them talking all the time, it's a different story altogether. But there's all kinds of ways that you can do it. And if you have a group that, again, has that distributed capacity and that was able to organize its on-the-spot decision about how they're progressing in their own conversation, you would have some people that would say, oh, let's take a minute to think on our own about this. Or let's take a moment to go in small groups, have a conversation and then come back. Or I don't know, or let's do a different kind of dynamics, or let's draw something. You know, like, there's so many ways that you can diffuse the way that people are engaging with a particular piece of content. And I think, yeah, but people don't necessarily see all these options because they need some more process literacy.
Absolutely. And I like the way how you shifted your mindset about these people who monopolize conversations. And it almost feels like an elastic, where if you don't have them at all and everyone is just silent, there's no energy in the room. But then if there's someone overstretching it, it might explode and then it takes all the energy out of the conversation.
Yeah.
And I think the starting with a silent brainstorm and then going into small groups, like in the 1-to-4-all structure, is a good way also to not to provide the stage for these people to share mm-hmm. too much, because at least if they're taking the space, it's only in a small group and only one or two people suffer, not everyone.
Yeah.
So what is your favorite exercise to know?
In general?
Yes, please.
What to do with that? Well, in general, I don't really have like, because I sort of come across different things at different times and get interested to playing them out. Even though, I mean, and this is one I've blogged recently about what I see as my 10 commandments of facilitation. I think it's really...
Did you publish them?
Yeah.
Oh, I will put the link in the show notes.
Sure. Yeah. And one of them is actually to not sort of fall in love with your own needs and your own hobby horses. You know, it's very easy for a facilitator to decide, oh, I'm going to do this because I really want to find out. And look, we actually do need a space to sort of do safe fail practicing, etc. But not in a big workshop. And I mean, not in a public thing. You have other opportunities to try it out, but you shouldn't be falling in love with your own tactics. But so, yeah, that said, so I do have phases when I'm sort of exploring different things, but there's a few things that I keep on using on a regular basis, but there's one that I like particularly, and it comes from the Liberating Structures repertoire, and it's called Troika Consulting, mm-hmm. whereby, you know, it's a little bit like peer assist, if that rings a bell, or intervision, it's called in Holland. But it works with three people, and in turn, everyone is like the client explaining an issue and the other two consultants clarifying first. And then the client turns their back or shuts their screen if it's online and listens to the conversation of the two consultants that are actually talking to one another, not to the client.
Yeah.
And I find this so great at so many levels because A, it's super simple, super easy to set up. Everyone is playing the role. So there is no, you know, like one person that is just a client and everyone plays everything. You actually get to really listen deeply because you're forced to. There is no other option. You actually get to hear about practical solutions for your problems, but also to other problems. So it's actually really bringing a lot of solutions. And on top of it, because of all the dynamics, it reinforces the trust and the bonding and the relationship between people. So such a simple thing for me that also, I think I'm particularly inclined to using it because it's a feedback mechanism. And I think feedback is a magical thing, and it's a superpower that everyone can use, and we just don't use it enough. So whenever we can, yeah.
Yeah, I love Troika Consulting, plus one on everything you just said. And yes, feedback is magic. And feedback, I think it's similar to what you mentioned about conversations, that everyone expects us to do it, or meetings. It's just what we do, but nobody told us how to do it. I mean, there are now more and more courses and literature about feedback. And I think the best book that I ever read about it has the author name, Thanks for the Feedback.
Oh, yeah. It's my Bible also.
Yes, yes. And for me, the big eye-opener was that actually, when we say feedback, we are not specific enough whether we mean evaluation, whether we mean coaching, or whether we mean praise.
Supportive. Yeah.
And that usually we deliver something that we have in mind. Again, we're in love with our own thoughts and forget what the other person actually wants.
Or needs. Yeah, no, exactly. And if we give feedback, because I mean, in most cases, people don't give any feedback whatsoever. And if they do give feedback without even realizing it's negative feedback, let alone, you know, constructive feedback. So,
or actionable feedback.
Yeah.
A feedback that does not involve a clearly actionable item is just rambling. It's not feedback. And still we give it the labor feedback.
Yeah.
And I think to come back to the Troika Consulting, what I think is the small detail that makes all the difference is, as you explained, that the two consultants speak about the client and not to the client. Yeah. So it's basically, it's not feedback, you should do this.
Yeah.
But it's, oh yeah, this person is sharing that. So I think, so they make it about themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think also it forces you not only as a client to listen, but also to not intervene and sort of defend yourself, because that's the natural inclination. It's like, oops, no. I mean, honor this. This is like receiving feedback non-defensively. It's really great.
Yeah, it's like a gift. When I do it online, I ask the clients to mute themselves.
Yeah.
Exactly. to really indulge and feel into themselves. Yeah. And you mentioned liberating structures, and I signed up for your immersion workshop. I'm very much looking forward to that. Finally, it took me years. And it's time to get into the student seat again. What is the relation between liberating structures and process literacy?
So, well, I think there's a lot, because I think it's simplifying process. Liberating structures for me is it's a whole repertoire that I'm sort of marveling at, because it's a little bit like the Dutch national identity. You know, it's like if you spend 3 months here or 6 months or 1 year, you're going to have a different opinion about what is going on in the country. You just like, it's just so many layers to that onion that you need to peel off. And it's the same with liberating structures. It really looks at first for most people like, oh, it's just like a nice repertoire of some structures, some exercises I've seen somewhere else, somehow repackaged, whatever, not done in a neat way. There's so much more to it than meets the eye. So much more. There's a whole layer of language that is actually at first actually even off-putting. I mean, to the extent that I even felt at the beginning that it really felt to me like it was a bit of a cult. People that were in the liberating structures cult, you know, it's like, oh yeah, you know, it's okay. It's like Apple fans, like, yeah, I'm sure it's fine, but I don't need to be part of your cult, you know. But actually, the language itself has got a lot of playfulness about it, and also a lot of interesting invitations to look at things differently. So there's a lot of mirrors of lenses in liberating structures. There's a lot of feedback loops and mirror effects of how the structures and the language of the structures is reflecting on each other in many different ways. I'll come back probably also to how the structures are combinable, but that is also very noticeable there. But the point is, with liberating structures, you go deep fast. That's the thing. It looks like something innocuous, something like, oh yeah, simple, business as usual, whatever. And you start witnessing, first of all, what it does to interactions without, again, a facilitator, central stage that is saying, oh, you know, I'm the one to bring you the magical process, whatever. Everyone is involved in that. But yeah, you start seeing what it does. And you also start seeing how there's always deeper implications. And so some things that look really harmless, I'm thinking about another liberating structure called TRIZ, which starts really playfully by asking people to imagine a complete nightmare scenario of what is going on. And then everyone is like playful. Yeah. Let's imagine, you know, we do this and that, etc. And the second step is, okay, now looking at the list of terrible behaviors, are there any of them that possibly you're remotely guilty of here and there? And then it's like, there's a bit of this and a bit of that, etc. I think it's such an eye opener. It's so potent. So little. So the connection with process literacy is that because it is so simple, because it doesn't actually require a long experience as facilitator, it is process literacy in a box. It brings anyone, any group, any person in a capacity to quickly change their interactions and to start paying attention to the distribution, to the timing, to a lot of things that are part of process literacy. I think that's really powerful.
Process literacy in a box. I love that. Yeah. Because when I think of literacy, obviously it's learning a language. And you mentioned that the language around the liberating structures is something, but each structure is also like a part of a language or a letter in the alphabet that you can combine into strings.
They follow a grammar. They have like five components that are always there in each of the structures. And that's the grammar of liberating structures. But then, yeah, you can actually form your sentences, stringing structures, stretching structures, because there's really an invitation to actually also imagine, reinvent how some of the structures are done. There's also a very, very active sub-movement within the liberating structures community, which is not a very homogeneous community worldwide anyway. It's lots of different people doing lots of different things, but that are basically really busy with developing new structures. And then there's the nesting. Like, for instance, you bring a bigger structure that takes, say, 30 to 60 to 90 minutes or 2 hours, whatever. And inside that, even inside one structure, you can actually bring another structure. One of the things that we did in one of the immersion workshops, for instance, was ecocycle planning, which is another structure that I really love for the lens that it brings on how you look at your activities or relationships. And inside that, we nested some spiral journal, which is some way to reflect for yourself about certain things. And the combination of that, you just start seeing like, wow. So maybe one of the other powers, and I don't want this to be just about liberating structures really, but it is quite remarkable that it's a repertoire that keeps on calling more of itself onto it. And that's the thing that is both amazing and also a bit daunting and a bit concerning for me that, you know, I feel like the more I invest my time and space in liberating structures, the more I need to do that because there's just so many options within just that repertoire to just reshape everything, all kinds of interactions. There's things it doesn't do well, but in general, there's almost endless possibilities. So,
yeah, it reminds me a little bit of the Dunning-Kruger effect that if you just know a little bit, you tend to become overconfident. I figured that out. Liberating structures, just common sense. And if you know how to facilitate, even not, you can use it. And then as you described, if you dive into it, you realize actually I have no clue and there's so much more.
One quick aspect also that is a little bit of an aside, but I think one of the other powers, and that's maybe it's resonating with me because I come from the world of knowledge management, learning, you know, that's how I got into facilitative work, is that it is an open source movement. So basically the inventors, the founders have said from the start, make it your own. You can make money out of it. You just need to pay respect, pay tribute where it's due. But otherwise, make it your own, just play with it. And I think that is also a real strength compared to a lot of facilitative practices and consultancies that are really protecting with copyrights, et cetera, their work. I understand where they're coming from, but I think that's one of the big powers of liberating structures and why it's sort of spreading out so fast. I call it the silent revolution sometimes, liberating structures, because of that.
Nice. Yes, and silent revolution maybe also because it's applicable. I think when we boil it down, and correct me if I'm wrong, because as I said, I haven't done my immersion workshop yet. But from what I understand, it relies on a few basic principles. Is one, there are different personalities, so it's important to respect those who need thinking time. So start with a silent brainstorm first. Second, we cannot have meaningful conversations in larger groups, and a larger group starts beyond four people. So break it down. And it takes time to grasp a big complex thing. So make it easy and start with the easiest, the quick win to tackle first, the one aha moment, and then take it from there because then you already have the energy.
Yeah, I've just displayed behind all the different principles because I think again, a lot of things like, duh, you know, it makes sense when you see it. It's like retrospective coherence. Once you know something, all of a sudden it makes perfect sense. But to actually come up with that simplicity, yeah, it's quite difficult.
Greetings, listeners. Dancing with Markers has launched a new online self-paced course on visuals designed with facilitators in mind. Stop making boring, meaningless slide decks and start bringing visuals into your meetings in a fun, purposeful, and creative way that will have a real impact on improving the outcomes of your meeting. Visuals are central to facilitating engaging meetings, but so many facilitators and trainers lack a strong design muscle to create fun and purposeful flip charts, slides, and visual templates. For the facilitator who wants to incorporate better visuals into your meetings, this course is designed to transform you into a confident visual facilitator. Find the link to purchase in the show notes with a special 10% off coupon just for Workshops Work listeners. Now, back to the show.
And I would be curious, with all the experience that you have, and I guess you came across many people who tried liberating structures and maybe have questions, where can it go wrong? So what would be your advice to an inexperienced facilitator, maybe just a team leader who buys the Liberating Structure book or goes on the website and thinks, oh, I'm going to do that and it will be the silent revolution now. Everything will be fine.
What can go wrong? So there's a few things that I can think of off the top of my head. One is I think liberating structures are not good at certain things. And then, for instance, achieving consensual decision-making is not one of the strong suits of liberating structures. And that's for me, that's on the other hand, the holy grail of facilitative work. That's really why facilitators are maybe, or facilitative skills are required in the first place. But it does very well everything else around that. But so if you try to stretch them to do that, I think, you can get there, but it's really not very graceful. Well, it's an interesting dance. It's on the one hand to be too rigid in applying the structures, exactly like textbook. For instance, if you look at what's on the website or in the book, it's quite a different story to the practice of some people that have been using it for a while. And I think that's because, yeah, we keep on refining it, etc. at the same time, freeing yourself entirely from the timings and from some of the principles of each of the structures also doesn't help, because there is something, there's one of the structures in liberating structure is really important to know. It's called wicked questions. And that's that paradoxical thinking of not thinking either or, but and. So liberating structures in itself is a wicked question. How can we be wanting to have liberating interactions and at the same time wanting structure to make it happen? The premise of liberating structures is that a tiny bit of structure is going to liberate interactions. If you have no structure whatsoever, you end up in entropy with, again, the highest paid person opinion that is dominating the place, etc. With too much structure, like the status report, the presentation, you basically you calcify the interactions also. So it's like a fine balance to find there. But I think those can also go wrong. And I would say the final thing, it's not related to liberating structures, but what I do notice some former graduates of immersion workshops having some difficulties with is just to stand their ground, to just having like enough confidence to say, well, let's give it a try. And if they encounter a little bit of resistance for the language or different reasons, then it can also go wrong. But yeah, that's just a life quest, I think, also.
Very true.
Self-confidence.
Very true. Two things come to my mind. One is the concept that in order to think out of the box, we first have to define the box.
Yeah.
So we do need the restrictions to think big. And the second is, yeah, standing the ground. And I think a big risk is, or an easy trap is, let's give a few minutes more. Let's give them a few minutes more. And this is where it goes wrong, because the having only 4 minutes or 5 minutes to discuss, you have enough time to go sufficiently deep without getting lost in the details.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's indeed very tempting for people to want to find the space that they're used to. And I mean, I do realize the pacing is a particularly difficult thing. It's a challenging thing for many, many, many folks. But we'll explore that in the immersion workshop. There's some reasons why, and indeed you're sort of hinting at some of them here.
And I wonder to what extent it's the constant doubt as a facilitator. You stand there, you have the responsibility for the group, for the process. And then somehow, might they need some more time?
Yeah.
You have to give them time, and then it's this urge to be liked or to be in service, which is actually a false friend. It's like parents who say yes all the time, although children appreciate the no.
I think it's at the junction of that. I think it's really well worded what you're saying about wanting to please people and not to be seen as the policeman, etc. I mean, indeed, for instance, by myself, time management is the one thing that I really, really hate about facilitation. In fact, thanks to Sam Gaynor and his gang, I've learned to distribute that responsibility also with my person in charge, and that's such a liberating thing. Also,
anyway, share with us. So what's now? I need to know.
Okay, shall I mention that and then coming back to the pleasing and the confusion, because I think that's really an interesting one. Yeah, so basically, I mean, what I've learned through Sam is involve your person in charge, whoever that is. You know, the person could be the sponsor, but it could also be for a particular segment of an interaction, a person that has been designed as appointed as the person in charge. And rather than you calling the shot, saying like, oh, we're just going to cut short, etc. No, actually, especially if you intervene as an external facilitator in this case, you basically lay the responsibility with the leader, with the person in charge you can just mention, look, I'm seeing that we're not going to have the time to reach the point we wanted to reach in the time given. What do you want to do? Do you want to continue this conversation, or do you want to cut it short? And you leave that responsibility to them, because it is their meeting. It is not yours, you know? And they have, especially if you're not a content matter specialist in that particular subject, you're maybe less equipped to find out whether the conversation has gotten exactly where it could be. Whereas the person in charge really brings that in. And so, and it also means, otherwise they're very happy to let you do everything, but actually it's really great to involve, again, it's process literacy. It's like, hey, this is what it entails. Another opportunity.
Yes.
So the other thing that you were saying about, so I think it's, how did you frame it? It's like, you're sometimes you don't want to cut people short because you don't want to displease others, etc. And I think that does happen. The other thing is it's also about cultivating, maybe a concept we're going to unravel a little bit together, called Confuciasm. Mm-hmm. It's cultivating the confusion of people, and confusion not so much for the sake of confusion. It's like, you know, to fail fair. Your intention is not to fail, but it's like to embrace failure to do something positive out of it. Same thing with confusion. Confusion means that you're learning. So Confuciasm is the enthusiasm for confusion, because that means, hey, there is something happening and I want to keep on being confused, because that means I'm sort of educating my questions, etc. And I think part of that means that everyone in interactions should be somehow a little bit easier and a little bit less uncomfortable with quick and dirty, with not perfect solutions, with safe fail. Failing forward is one of the key principles of liberating structures, and for a very good reason. We need that. And in many, many workplaces, we're not encouraged. We need to have like the perfect plan, the perfect publication, the perfect decision. Well, you know, I mean, what's it called? Agile and Scrum, they're not going that way for a very good reason.
Exactly. And I think it's a wicked question as well, where corporates don't allow for failure and still they have a learning department. So if you assume that everyone knows, then nobody needs to learn. It's only when you assume that there's something you are missing, then you need to learn. And then, of course, you're going to fail because it is a process. What I like about this Confucianism, I love the concept.
Confuciasm. Otherwise, Confuciasm. It becomes a religion almost.
Confuciasm. Yeah, it's a yasm too much. Confuciasm.
Yeah.
Yes, it sounds like the constant buildup of new synapses between neurons. So if you're not, only if you're confused, you realize that there's a missing link. So you see that there are different pieces of information in your brain, but they're not connected yet. And that's why you're confused.
Yeah.
And then the process of building these bridges and combining these neurons is, a powerful one. Thank you for bringing that up.
And it's got a sort of a pending image, or the nemesis of being confusiastic is, you know, the expert that has the sort of the achieved expert. I'm an expert. So, you know, I have reached that level where I don't need to question my content. It's got a relation with content and process here, I think, because that's one of the things that we sort of explored in our pre-chat. But I think, how to encourage people to be confusiastic and to not focus only on the content. I think it's indeed to cultivate that appreciation for the fact that we are all contributing. I mean, I think it's safe to expect everyone to see that change is the only constant now. You know, it's like, I mean, certainly the past.
Not only now.
Yeah, exactly. So this is what's going on. So how can you say, no, I don't need to learn? So no, we do need to learn. Yeah. And one way to sort of not rest on our laurels is to assume that we are not expert, that we keep on learning. And I think if you are a process specialist, by definition, it's so complex, it's so social that you keep on learning and you keep on having to be open. But in a subject matter, in a content expertise, you can really go down. And at some point, indeed, you feel like I've actually reached a thing, even though I assume that real scientists are still questioning. They still know that they don't know. The more they know that they don't know. Yeah,
exactly. And I in a previous podcast recording with Dov Zahl, he said there's only one thing that everyone is for sure the world expert in, and people should only talk about the one thing that they're world expert in, and that's ourselves.
Yeah.
And so we can speak as much as you want about the truth, which is ourselves, because all the rest, we actually have no clue. Maybe some have more clues than the other, but when it most probably not even. And when we look at astrophysics or quantum mechanics, we realize that actually there's even the most brightest people on Earth have no clue.
Yeah, I mean, to talk about a very personal example about this, I'm actually really I'm flabbergasted that epilepsy is a condition that one of my sons has. And it touches, it's estimated around 3% of the world population. And it's really like a condition that everyone has heard of in their life, if not witnessed it somehow. And yet, I mean, our medicine has no idea where it comes from and how to really deal with it. For instance, how to, some applications like ketogenic diets can really make a difference in the way that that the body processes and deals with epilepsy. So it's, we really don't know very much about our world around. Even ourselves, I'd wager we actually don't know very much about ourselves either, to be honest. But
This is very true. Yeah, and maybe these are the kind of, thank you for sharing your story. And maybe it's by being confronted to these difficult revelations that even for something so important that is so close to us, there is no answer out there. And then how to deal with this disc, and this is a real discomfort. How to deal with it.
So I think, I mean, for me, this is also, I think it's part of, you know, one of the key lessons, two lessons of life for me. I don't know if this is going to be recorded, by the way, it's really going a little bit outside, but one is everything is love. That's really the absolute truth. It's like, if there's one truth that I want to live in my life, it's that one. And the other one is to really, as you progress in life, to let go of things more and more and more. And part of letting go is about letting go of that certainty, of that security of things. It's really embracing that confusion, because it's also embracing questions instead of answers, because questions make you progress. Answers are just like, they're just going to give you a state of the art at some point, but it's not. I mean, science is only true until it's proven wrong the next time around. And even having worked in the scientific world for the past 10 years or so, I'm sometimes surprised that some scientists have completely forgotten that at the bottom of science should be that questioning, not the we have found a solution. You know, it's interesting.
Yeah, and that's, I think that we, by the environment that we face, by the space in which we live and the incentives that we are faced to, it does shape our behavior and how we communicate. So I think in a world where you have a higher competition amongst scientists with having all the A journal publications and having not enough tenured positions whatsoever, yes, you have to at least show this overconfidence, which is not useful and which then makes them forget over time what science is actually about. And I think the same is true for the space we give to our collaborative work or group conversations. If we define the space as being something competitive where we have to find answers and to have to prove our point because there are limited resources and there is only limited way to move up the ladder, then of course we'll get these hard conversations that lack any empathy and curiosity.
Yeah, well, at least that can also be a good thing to have. I mean, I'm not sure that actually all the hard conversations necessarily lack empathy either. But yeah, I mean, it's again unhelpful. This is again something that I've learned with the community at work crew, because I mean, yeah, next to liberating structures, as you understand, this is like it's a major source of influence, and it really came quite late in my facilitative pathway. But I think, yeah, appreciating the value of again confusion among the members of a group, of frustration with each other, of the grown zone, is just like it's so important. And I used to really feel ill at ease with that, you know, with people sort of starting to attack each other, etc. Once you actually really understand the value that it can bring, the value of conflict, it can be a majorly generative force in the room or in the, you know, on the screen or whatever. So I don't shy away from it quite as much. It's usually an indication that there is something very interesting there that is maybe going to go beyond the cliches of the business as usual, you know. So an opportunity to go beyond.
True. And usually if we have strong emotional reactions, it means that there is either a blind spot or maybe something that we don't want to admit or see.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, even to talk back about the example of the people that are taking too much space in a conversation, or like, for instance, one of the typical patterns that I think many of us have come across is someone that just keeps on, you know, coming back to the same point. And at first, you could be like, oh, there he is again, like rambling on about the same thing. But if you don't actually invite these people to really express themselves, they're going to keep on rambling. So it's like, and I think that's where, again, the point with process literacy, if the entire group starts developing that empathy and develops that process vision and their skills for listening and for paying attention and for inviting other voices, they create conditions for these people to express themselves and to let go of these ideas and to move on to something else. And that's something that I see, for instance, in this study group, because it's full of people that have cultivated very strong group facilitation skills. There is natural support for each other and natural warmth and empathy and an invitation for voicing anything that is on our heart or in our mind, no matter how annoyingly people communicate it. And I think that's beautiful without the intervention of the person facilitating that particular segment.
Yes, and I made the same connection back to our earlier conversation about to what extent is it really relevant to have one facilitator. And I think if I put together all the pieces that you have mentioned throughout our conversation of also distributing tasks to other participants. So once you start distributing these tasks, okay, today you're in charge of the timekeeping and you're in charge to make sure that the conversation is still directed towards the purpose and that we are still talking about the how and not getting lost in the what, then, and you have mastered or at least are working on these skills of self-awareness, curiosity, listening, respect, then basically the role of the one facilitator can dissolve.
Exactly, progressively. And it's just so much more worth it. I'll tell you another personal anecdote, which is part of my wedding with my now future ex-wife was facilitated. There was a segment where we wanted our different sort of language communities to mingle, etc. And also we involved them in the preparation of the wedding, because it was like, you know, in a very, very informal setting where we had it in a sort of a countryside farm, renovated farm where my in-laws have a house. And it was so great. So the day before, and also, I mean, to undo, but particularly to prepare, lots of people played a role. And the thing that happens is once they start playing even a minor role, they're invested emotionally at such a different level in that wedding. And I think it was like really a love fest because of that reason. Same thing in a room. You involve people in all kinds of things. They start finding it much more interesting.
I simply love that example. I mean, co-creating a wedding, and it is the IKEA effect. We get attached to something that we build ourselves. And then by definition, your wedding will become meaningful.
Yeah.
I think this is a topic that Lily Groh on her podcast would be very curious about. Mm. Let me make this connection.
Yeah. No, so that's why for me, you know, how to cultivate processes. You see, even if, I mean, of course, ideally you'd get everyone to sort of get trained, coach, practice together, etc., on using facilitative skills and on at some point teaching or introducing some key concepts such as types of meetings, group dynamics, group decision making, all of that. But even if you can't do that, for me, it's like, because we focus on the what, we focus with our ears on what is being said. It's like, if you start making the process scaffolding visible for everyone, it creates aha moments. And it takes as little as, for instance, telling people, look, when you start a question and answer session, if you start asking a woman to come up with the first contribution, that it's much more likely that more women are going to feel invited to, because otherwise, you know, it's like Maggie Thatcher used to say, if you want something said, ask a man. If you want something done, ask a woman. It's the one sensible thing that she said, at least. But so in any case, it's that. Or it's like, for instance, I sometimes had like teaching to people how to not eat the microphone on face to face, but also not have like, you know, what is eat the microphone is for me the hard rock stance or death metal stance. But then you have like also the reggae stance, like so relaxed, you know, I mean, no one can hear me anymore. Like, so all these little things, it just like it starts getting people to think, hey, there is something else to just the conversation we're having. There's something around it that I start seeing. And I think once that aha moment, I've seen some people like talking about scientists that were so touched by the power of process that they decided to actually completely change careers and move into sort of facilitative kind of work. So incredible.
Absolutely.
I think also because next to that, we talk about process, but the other big, big thing that is part of that process literacy that facilitators cultivate is relationships. It really is such a human field. It's getting people to connect. And for me, this is one of the reasons why 10, 12, 15 years into this, I still love it, because I get to know about different topics, but particularly seeing that aha moment of people connecting, collaborating, seeing the point of sticking their head out of the sand and connecting with others. It's magic in front of my eyes.
And there's always something to learn. And every time it's different because of the group dynamics.
Yeah.
In your experience, what makes a workshop fail?
Well, I think it's, it's obviously it's a lack of process literacy, of course. but I mean, yeah, what does it mean is I think it's some laziness. It is laziness. You know, a lot of people just call up meeting or organize meetings and they really haven't been giving much thought about it. You know, it's like there's a cartoon that goes, don't know what to do, getting bored at work, call up a meeting. And I think there's a bit of that happens that sometimes people just, yeah, they have a vague idea of something that they might want to do, but if they really sort of scratch behind the surface, they're going to find out that maybe a meeting is not required. Because I love collaboration and I encourage people to collaborate whenever it makes sense, but I don't encourage everyone to collaborate all the time, everywhere with everyone. It really is very pricey and difficult and exhausting at times. And so it's also something that people need to pay attention to. So I think, yeah, it's laziness in paying attention to the why, in thinking about exactly what the outcomes are going to be, in exactly thinking what kind of dynamics you're going to be needing. So of course, next to that also come again the same principles of how does group dynamics work, how do you come to a decision, etc. I think it's also sometimes emotional and ethical laziness. So sometimes you're just not paying attention to the people that should really be there and how they're going to be involved. And how you're going to involve them emotionally also, or respect their emotions and their feelings about it. There's a lot of things that can really go wrong because of that. And then, yeah, I think these for me would be the bigger things.
Yeah. And I like the concept of emotional laziness. And I think it's also relates to the participants or contributors, as Nadia said, in the workshop. The emotional laziness related to what you observed is how to embrace those who trigger strong emotions in us, because it is difficult. And I think especially when we are hungry or when we are tired or when it comes to the end or we have something different in mind, we are emotionally lazy for good reasons.
Yeah.
But then it makes it difficult to actually embrace this learning and growth opportunity.
Yeah. Mm. And but I mean, still, and as you know, as I'm sure it's been probably a standard response to that question, I think that by far, I mean, it really is the lack of why, the lack of questioning why. You know, it's like this is, again, it's celebrating structures, nine whys. If you start asking yourself the nine whys of anything, you start seeing much more than you originally thought. And I think we just it's a normal human being tendency to just settle for the minimal effort, you know. So,
gets to the identity of our belief system, we tend to avoid that. Mm. Our brain is not made for self-questioning. It's made for survival. So why would we make it difficult?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, why bother, really? Yeah. So I think that's that. Yeah. But yeah, many, many other things can happen. Eh?
I cannot believe that we're already talking for an hour.
Yeah, I was just also looking. It's like, yeah, we're beyond 12 indeed.
Yeah. If someone fell asleep after minute two, just woke up and doesn't have time to listen to the entire conversation, what would you like them to walk away with?
I think don't believe in the fact that you trust or you need to trust one facilitator. Cultivate facilitative skills and spread them around, because we can all benefit from those in our interactions, in our life, in our work, in ourselves, in everything we do. And it's really something, it's a blossoming for the taking, and we should all contribute to planting the seeds of the tree garden, le verger. And I had the French name in mind.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your enthusiasm, for sharing, for your experience. Really enjoyed the conversation, and send me the link to your 10 commandments. I will put them in the show notes, and to your immersion workshop, of course.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll send you that. Well, thank you very much, Miriam. I've really enjoyed it. It's been super nice to have this very nice and organic conversation. And I look forward to, well, more episodes anyway of your podcast, because I think it's a great initiative which you have.
Thank you.
Thank you for staying tuned and listening to the show. I appreciate your attention, as I know how busy you are. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and engage by sharing your comments and thoughts, and visit workshops.org to download the one-page summary. I'm looking forward to seeing you back at the next episode, and I wish you a fruitful day.